we became very self-sufficient, that a lot of that and had no idea what was going on in the world or outside those boundaries. Yeah, and the same with the white fellas out there. Only now when they're reading the book, they're all shocked. They said, we had no idea this went on. Okay, my name's Leslie Williams. I'm an Aboriginal woman from southeast Queensland. I grew up on the Sherbeg Aboriginal community in southeast Queensland.
Queensland being, of course, a state in Australia, it's huge. It's in the northeastern corner.
Grew up there during the 1940s, 50s and 60s before being contracted out to work as a domestic.
What's a domestic? How did Leslie Williams come to be one? And it's understating to say much, much more. I'm James Milsom, and this is The Rulebook.
What does it look like? What did it look like at the time, Sherbeg?
Sherbeg was just a very closed community. It was just basic, where you had segregation there. You had an area where the Aboriginal people all lived, and there was a separate area where the white officials lived. And then,
so Sherbourg, Cherburg, it is. You can Google it if you want to see some images. Essentially, very simple, small town. It's a settlement, really, purpose built to contain, really, Aboriginal people from far-flung areas in Queensland into one place. More on that a little later.
It was very self-contained. So we became very self-sufficient. That a lot of that and had no idea what was going on in the world or outside those boundaries.
And what year was it that you were put to work?
I was sent out as a domestic in 1964.
And you were how old?
I was 16, just turned 17.
And 17 was late, as Leslie told me. She was only sent out so late because she was helping her grandmother look after the younger children in her family, and that was only because her older siblings had already gone. And they'd gone to work as domestics. So let's define that.
I was a domestic servant, meaning like a housemaid. Housemaid where you were contracted out to work for families out on cattle properties, sheep stations, or just ordinary dairy farms, or in private home, white homes in throughout Queensland, including down here in Brisbane.
So Leslie's heading out to her new job as a domestic, and what she has in her hand becomes crucial later on.
When I was sent out, I carried a brown envelope. Inside the brown envelope was a work agreement that was to be signed by the employer between the employer and the government. James, I'm telling you, with all this information I'm giving you now, it's important for the listeners out there to know that I only discovered what I was carrying in that brown envelope was in 1992.
And 3 decades later, Leslie turned the government document archives upside down to try to find the documents that she had held in her hand on that day.
So went out in 1964, terrified to open the envelope. My employer met me at the station out west. It was about a couple of hundred kilometres west of one of the main towns in Queensland, southwest Queensland, and then everything was fine, was paid pocket money, and the bulk of my wage was to be sent back to be kept in trust for me.
Now, on that note, this notion of trust, let's invite another person along to help us tell the story. This is
Tony Woodgett. I'm the director of the Queensland
Public Interest Law Clearinghouse, but actually at the time that Tony comes into the story, he was working at the Caxton Legal Centre.
And it's a community legal centre that
And you probably realise, but I think they're called different things in different parts of the world. Community Legal Centre, essentially a place you can go to get free legal advice. Tony's going to help answer a few questions. A couple of the first ones are, why was Leslie sent out to do this work? And why didn't she get paid for it? So there's this law that was passed. It only applies to Aboriginal people. As we know, Aboriginal, well, the dictionary definition says that it means the people who were here first. Anyway, this law.
It required them to work as cattlemen and domestics in far-flung places, and a percentage of their wage from that work was taken by the government and held in individual bank accounts.
And not many of the people who were doing the work knew where their money was going, and even of those who knew where the money was going, it was pretty hard to find out how to get to
it. And also, some of that money was used for their own upkeep, for living in the reserves and for general reserve purposes.
More on that shortly. Right now, let me tell you that this legislation, it was called the Aboriginal Protection and Restriction on the Sale of Opium Act of 1897. Now, if you just thought to yourself, that needs some explaining, I agree. This is Stephen Gray. He is from Monash University in Melbourne. He lectures in Aboriginal affairs and law and some other stuff.
Yeah, well, in the 1890s, which was when the first Queensland legislation was passed, 1897, I think, the impetus for that first protective legislation was actually well-intentioned in a way. It was designed to stop the kind of most obvious, gruesome or horrible things that were happening on the frontier as far as, you know, white stockmen, European drovers, other people on the frontier, lone white men basically on the frontier, kidnapping Aboriginal women and keeping them as sex slaves, raping them, or and also the issue of part Aboriginal kids, obviously born to white fathers and Aboriginal mothers, was of great concern and really shame, I guess, to the broader population. And part of that was bound up with the idea that opium and alcohol and other drugs were being peddled to Aboriginal people. It was actually wound up with anti-Asian feeling as well. So a lot of that feeling as far as opium was concerned was directed at Chinese.
So this legislation only came in like 120 years after the first English ships anchored in Sydney. And so it's really not that long that white people have been in Australia. The other thing to note or to remember is in the 1850s or thereabouts, gold was discovered in Australia, much like what's happened in the rest of the world with gold rushes. Same thing happened here. People came from other parts of the world. They brought opium and shovels, I guess. Coming back to our story, though, that happened in 1897. And around the same time, similar law came in other parts of Australia. But Leslie's story is all centering around 1964. So we've really got to get a sense of what was happening in Queensland then.
This pre-1970s was a time when Aboriginal people were seen very differently. They weren't legally equal in many, many ways. They didn't have rights to be counted in the census, for example, and all kinds of other sort of equality rights that we take for granted. This was the period of the Stolen Generations, when Aboriginal kids or part Aboriginal kids were very frequently taken away from their home environments and brought up in institutions, in the kind of the justification for that being that they would have a better chance of attaining civilization, so-called, if brought up in that way. So there was a general view of Aboriginal culture as being inferior. In the work environment, that played out with the idea that Aboriginal people were slow workers, that they weren't as capable as other people. They were legally actually regarded as wards, or as, you know, there were special categories that related to them at that time, and so they essentially got less pay than other people for the same work, or sometimes no pay at all.
So that's sort of the texture of the social, political, and cultural fabric that the kind of underlay this legislation. Tony can give us a bit of an idea for what how some people felt.
There were many people who were upset with this regime, but they accepted it because they'd been very much disempowered by the whole structure.
Now, quickly back to me stumbling into a question for Leslie.
I get the feeling you didn't understand, and nobody really understood at the time, but you now understand what the legislation was that gave them the power to do that trust arrangement.
Yeah, at the time, I didn't understand because I'm thinking we only received limited education and you didn't dare question the authorities because what had happened to me and it happened to older sisters, and it turns out I found out after doing this research that it happened to my parents and even my grandparents. So it goes back to the 1890s when all of this scheme was happening.
Okay, a lot of background. Let's now return to the story that we were telling.
We were given pocket money. We had no idea how much money we were to be paid. That was all done between the Queensland government and the white employer.
So eventually Leslie got married, had three kids, and this stuff sort of bubbled back up later on down the track, as I've kind of alluded to. And the start of it re-bubbling, if I can say that, happened at a kind of a weird place. It happened at Neverland.
Can you take me briefly to Neverland? Just because I can't resist hearing a little bit about it.
But Tammy needs to tell you about that. It was through an incident at school that she copped some racism, and then she's also a fan, very strong fan of Michael Jackson's, and so she wrote this letter about...
So there was a competition Michael Jackson's Heal the World Foundation had put on. Leslie's daughter Tammy wrote a letter, which was what you had to do to enter, and she won.
Won this competition, which then she took there and I to Neverland.
And that was to become this transformative experience, both for, I think, Leslie and Tammy. And I know that I'm jumping geographically and along the time spectrum a little bit, but Tarantino does it, so as can I. And right now we're back in Leslie's living room.
Okay. I saw an article in the papers in 1991. And then I saw the article, I read it, and then it really didn't click with me. And I thought, welfare fund, I'm thinking of the welfare committee in Cherbourg. But then as I read on a bit further down the mentioned, talked about people always earning money in the savings account went into this fund. So then I cut the paper out and I thought, I wonder what happened. This is what got me thinking then. I thought, I had money there for when I was sent out to these two properties, in the early 60s.
And this snapped Leslie into action. She started searching. She was looking for documents, something to prove that she earned this money and that it hadn't been paid to her, something to prove where it was and why it wasn't paid to her. She went to government departments. She turned over her own records. She went to family asking for something. Really, she was looking for whatever was in that brown envelope that she held in her hand on the train in 1964. The archives were stacked with documents. They started to pile up. She couldn't get through them all. She started making copies. Eventually, there was a groundswell. She was part of organising a protest in the centre of Brisbane, the capital of Queensland. And all the while, she's writing letters. Letters to
all the politicians,
officials
in Queensland and the
prominent people, politicians.
Petitions drawn up, Secretary General of the UN, and even to Bill Clinton.
Leslie later wrote that her shoebox-sized house was just filled with documents. There was paper stacked by the couch, by the beds, in the kitchen, by the TV. Everywhere was paper. And eventually, seemingly out of nowhere, she came upon, well, something that could help. And let's get to that just after this. Okay, prefacing this break chat with, I sincerely love making this podcast. That much cannot be in doubt. Okay, moving on. I don't get paid anything to make this, and I'm doing it anyway. That's cool. However, what would be really helpful is if I got some financial contribution. And what's a way that you can jump in and help support the podcast? Well, it's through this site called Patreon, patreon.com. There, you can pledge $2 or more a month. Each monetary amount comes with like a bit of a perk package. Some of them are like you get bonus content with episodes. In some of them, you get access to like a chat that happens after the episode comes out, and it's exclusive. It only happens with other people at a similar echelon, and so on and so forth. And there's lots more great, amazing, cool, exciting stuff that it's coming. Anyway, if you want to go there, give me a hand. That would be really great. patreon.com/therulebook or therulebook.xyz, and follow the links to support the rulebook. So what did Leslie find in her search? She found a passbook, and it contained records of all of the money that she was supposed to have been paid and where it was paid to.
And it turned out that my wage when I was sent out in 1964 was £3.10, of which I was supposed to receive weekly £1.10. And the other £2 to be sent back quarterly to be kept in trust for me at the Sherberg office.
This was proof, the proof that Leslie needed. So she got Tony on the phone.
I took a statement from her about this history. We then went through the process of trying to obtain the government records.
Tony and lawyers at the Caxton Legal Service got more documents. They put them together with the documents that Leslie already had. They saw that there were disparities. They saw that there were questions to be asked. So they got this barrister to give advice. Her name, Jean Dalton. She's now a Supreme Court Justice.
Then on Leslie's instructions, we drafted a statement of claim to the Supreme Court to commence legal proceedings against the state of Queensland.
And the claim?
Was for breach of trust.
So we've got to get a little bit legal at this point just to have a think about what a trust is as opposed to just the normal dictionary meaning of the word trust. And there's some relationship there, I guess. So trusts come from old English law, I suppose, when people lived in mud. Anyway, they are essentially a relationship between a trustee, the person being trusted, and a beneficiary, the person that the person being trusted is supposed to be looking after in some way. I think that a really good way to look at an example of a trust is thinking about Batman. I really love Batman analogies. You may have noticed from past episodes. So essentially, the way I see it anyway, when Mr. and Mrs. Wayne died, Bruce was really in the hands of Alfred, the family butler. All of the riches of the Wayne family were really being held in trust by Alfred for Bruce. And so in that circumstance, Alfred was the trustee and Bruce the beneficiary. And important to point out, the reason why Alfred needed to be in there as an intermediary, Bruce was a child, so he couldn't have his cash just yet. I guess I'm just fearful that you're going to think that I'm trivializing here. That's not it at all. I like looking at these things from a simpler and different point of view to take the heat out of it a little bit so that we can think about it and understand, like, what trusts are, just in a different context, so we can now apply that understanding to the case at hand. So just remembering, trustee looks after the whatever, beneficiary, the one who's meant to get the benefit of it.
The government is, by virtue of this regime, is in the role of trustee. It's got control over the people who were subject to that legislation. It was controlling some of their money, and if it did not properly look after that money, as appears to be the case, the government has breached its duties to the beneficiaries, so to the people who it was supposed to be looking after.
So before we plunge deeper into this court case, let's have a quick reflection on, well, what was in the minds of people in Leslie's position?
And did you understand at the time why that there was that deal? Why you couldn't just get the money in your pocket?
I had no idea. You wouldn't dare question it. You're going to be contracted out because your older sisters went out to work. And you know a lot of other girls and young boys went out to work. No one questioned it. You didn't dare question the white authorities until, well, not you, but if you did, you'd be punished, be threatened to be put in the dormitories or locked up in jail for daring to question you, standing up for your right. If an Aboriginal person dared to misbehaved or dared to talk back to a white official, that's where they were sent, split up from your family.
And technically there was a system to get your hands on your own money, but not that many people knew what it was or how to do it or felt comfortable to do it, but there was a government guy who was appointed as the protector of the Aboriginal people, and you had to go to this protector person?
And then say you'd like to withdraw some money. So your name would go down and you'd wait down there. It was Fridays. Every Friday you're allowed to go down to the office and check to see if your name is on the list, which was then granting you permission to withdraw some money. So there was a limit on what you could withdraw. I think it was £10. Anything over £10, you had to get permission, had to come from the director. And you had to explain why you want that amount of money.
Money that you had earned. Anyway, Leslie did have this understanding the whole time and held it throughout the process we've been talking about, that this wasn't just about her.
When I was getting more and more information, elders coming to our meetings, I realised then it was not about me, it's about thousands of other Aboriginal people. I wanted to highlight, I wanted to bring it out into the open so that the wider community, all the white fellas out there, they were always under the impression that Aboriginal people are lazy, never worked, don't like to work, they just like to live on handouts, which it was never ever the case.
And in the course of her investigations and preparing for her case, Leslie had actually figured out that the money that was earned by herself and these thousands of other Aboriginal people had been used by the state.
Loans were given out to various hospital boards around the state. They built new wings, they built kitchens, and in fact one hospital was actually built.
And as Tony told me, some of the money that was being earned by all of these people was being used to
run the reserves, the missions and the reserves, which is which in a sense means that the inmates, to use that word, were paying for their own care.
And we're about to come back to this idea of protection versus control. You and I, you might be thinking, are responsible for paying our own way as well. The big difference is that, broadly anyway, we get to choose where we go, where we work, where we live, and how we live. Aboriginal people under this regime weren't given that choice. Here's Stephen.
The missions would take Social Security or wages and use it in ways that they thought were for the best interests of the Aboriginal people. So they'd build, you know, toilet blocks or accommodation or whatever, which to them was fair, but I guess these are the kinds of services that government is supposed to be providing and does provide for the general communities.
So they were paying for the general upkeep of the reserve that they were required to stay in. They had no choice. They were controlled and had to stay in those places.
So with that in mind, let's head back to court. As we know, Leslie's gone to court asking a judge to make an order to say that there was a trust, that the trustee was the government, she was the beneficiary, and that the government had breached the trust in not giving her her money. But it didn't get to court. The case was settled.
We sat around the table and negotiated. And I said, I'm up here to, you know, well, I'm not sure, I can't remember now the exact legal words, but withdrew the writ or claim, whatever it's called, on the condition that the government moves forward and address this issue.
Effectively, Leslie was saying, I'll give up my claim if you, the government, deal with everyone else's.
If we went down the path individually, we'd be still going through the courts. And it'll be tying up the courts, tens of millions of dollars being spent. And a lot of our people are then passing away without seeing any form of money, let alone any acknowledgement.
And I asked Leslie, after all of these years of campaigning, of activism, of writing letters, of searching, of trawling through documents, of being bounced around between politicians and lawyers and all of these different people, let alone of working all of that time without getting paid, did she get any money?
Well, there was no money, but to me it was the acknowledgement and the letter of apology from the minister for the hurt that I was subjected to, and not only that, months later, government were then working out ways on how to address this, and that's when in May 2002, the BT government then made an offer. They made an offer to all Indigenous workers, that's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, who had their wages and savings controlled from 1897 right through to 1970s. The offer was for $55.4 million. And they worked out through working out the numbers who would be entitled, providing there was a record there that proved that their money and their wages were controlled, their wages as well as their savings and their work. And the elders who were born from early 1900s through to December 1951 received a one-off payment of $4,000. And then the younger ones who were born from January 1952 to December 1956, received a one-off payment of $2,000.
Is $4,000 enough?
$4,000, no. There was a lot of anger. A lot of people were very angry. Because some people worked 20, 30 years and have, you know, to have their money controlled.
So $55 million on paper in a news headline sounds like a win for the good guys, I guess, but not everyone thought so. Here's Tony.
The government hasn't really taken it seriously enough. You know, it's something that they can think that they can just throw, chips at, and that'll solve the problem rather than going to the extra length of really showing that there is some recognition of what happened, more than just, you know, paying them some money.
And the voices of dissatisfaction and dissent after this scheme of this $55 million in Queensland, they were loud enough that there was a federal government inquiry. There was a report. One of the many recommendations was a confirmation that the Queensland government hadn't done enough, that they needed to go back and have another look and do better.
You know, they revisited the scheme and made another offer of some more money, and I think it might have even been a little bit broader. But that's still happening. But also since, there have been other people who have not accepted the offer because it's not, it's even, I think it still amounts to, and I could be wrong here, but less than $10,000 per person.
So that brings us just about to present day. And after I recorded the interviews for this story, there was a class action filed in Queensland. That means essentially a big lawsuit with in this case, 300 plaintiffs. And these 300 plaintiffs are claiming the exact same thing that Leslie was.
Today, a 77-year-old Aboriginal man has taken legal action against the Queensland government to recover his stolen wages. Hans Pearson is one of 300 elderly Aboriginal people suing the government in a class action to get back money he earned but was never paid.
And this is John Bottomley. He's the lawyer behind the class action.
It's clearly a breach of trust. And so we're intending to take the matter to court along with all the other people. And we've already got 300 claimants.
So this is far from over. And I think that that's in part at least because it's just at its very heart is this issue of the treatment of Aboriginal people since Australia started being called Australia and the perception and treatment of them from then until the present day. It's a whole other conversation, but I did have a bit of it with Stephen.
Yeah, there was the idea that Aboriginal people were doomed to disappear. The phrase smooth the dying pillow, that it was the white civilization, it's the higher races, that their duty to do that on the way to the inevitable extinction of Aboriginal people. And I guess the whole basis on which European colonisation occurred was based on the idea that what you may have heard the phrase terra nullius, empty land, the idea that there weren't actually people whose civilization was worth being counted, I suppose. That was almost the whole basis for colonisation, and it certainly did play out in lots of different ways for Aboriginal people.
And it's like we've said already, this is about talking about protection and that amounting to control.
Was it good that they were wanting to protect Aboriginal people?
Well, that was the emphasis on it, but it turns out that so much for the protection. In fact, it was a form of control, because once you were then placed on these communities, every aspect of your life was controlled.
So there's this historic background that looms large even now. And to me at least, it sounds like for Leslie, it was a battle of those issues, and it was about addressing the conversations that are still going on around Australia, around bars and kitchen tables, in living rooms and in offices on construction sites. And the conversations are about Aboriginal people being dependent on the welfare system or lazy or, you know, we could go on. And this was a voice in that conversation.
It proved that we were never welfare dependent. We had a very good, strong work ethic. And we're always being committed to what we do.
Leslie has released a book that details much more beautifully this story and a lot of the surrounding events. She wrote it with her daughter Tammy, who you heard about earlier in the story, and who played a crucial role as well. It's a pretty amazing read. The book's called Not Just Black and White. I would really love to talk to people to converse about this story and all of the others, about the podcast in general, about what I'm doing right and what I could do better. All of this stuff would be so useful for me to hear about. So get in touch. You can tweet at me at Rulebook Podcast. You can contact me via the website, therulebook.xyz, or Facebook, facebook.com/rulebookpodcast, or just search for the Rulebook Podcast on Facebook. Thank you very much for listening once again. As I mentioned earlier, this thing takes a lot of work for me, and so it would be really fantastic to have some contribution financially from you if you're in a position to offer it. $2 a month is the starting point, and it goes up from there, as do the wonderful perks. I think that the main perk is the program that you're listening to right now. And so that's at Patreon, patreon.com/therulebook. Anyway, this episode was produced and everything by me, music by me. Thank you to the interviewees, Stephen Gray from Monash University, Tony Woodgett from the Queensland Public Interest Law Clearinghouse, and of course, Leslie Williams.
Trixie Studio.